York, this is Democracy Now!
Elon Musk, keep your hands off of Social Security!
Martin O'Malley, the former head of the Social Security Administration's, issued a dire warning that Social Security could collapse due to sweeping cuts by the Trump administration. O'Malley will join us to talk about why he fears millions of Social Security recipients could soon lose their benefits, or rather see them interrupted. Then to Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and Yale professor Greg Grandin, author of the new book, America, America, A New History of the New World.
Latin America is famous for its torture, for its dictatorships, its death squads, its disappearances. But alongside that, that history runs a deep, deep current of humanism, of a kind of commitment to universal democracy. That's quite amazing. And you think about it, when you think about the social movements that just keep fighting. You know, if democracy is measured by courage, I'd say that Latin America might be the most democratic region in the world today.
We'll speak with Professor Grandin about his book, The U.S. Sending Immigrants to a Notorious Mega Prison in El Salvador, The Death of the First Latin American Pope, and more. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, at least 10 Palestinians were killed, including a child, after an Israeli strike sparked a fire at a school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. There are among 24 Palestinians killed by Israeli airstrikes on Gaza since dawn. Separately, civil defense workers in northern Gaza report Israeli warplanes have blown up 9 bulldozers being used in humanitarian operations.
These machines serve us, removing the rubble from the streets and retrieving the martyrs from under the rubble. At the very least, they provide us with a room or tent above our homes. The Israeli occupation came and destroyed them. The occupation is still causing us harm.
On Tuesday, Gaza's health ministry said Israel's total blockade of Gaza had cut off access to polio vaccines, putting the lives of over 600,000 Palestinian children at risk. In New Haven, Connecticut, protests have erupted on the campus of Yale University over the planned speech this evening by Itamar Ben-Gvir, the far-right Israeli security minister who openly supports the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. In 2007, Ben-Gvir was convicted by an Israeli court of incitement to racism and supporting a terrorist organization. Overnight, about 200 student protesters erected a tent encampment, but canceled plans to occupy the space overnight, citing threats of retribution from administrators. Ahead of his visit to New Haven, Ben-Gvir attended a private dinner in his honor at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, alongside Republican lawmakers. Top diplomats from France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, as well as the United States, have postponed a high-level meeting with Ukrainian diplomats in London after U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said he would skip the talks. The diplomats were set to discuss the framework of a U.S.-proposed ceasefire deal to end Russia's war on Ukraine. The meeting's abrupt cancellation came as a Russian drone struck a bus in the city of Makhachkala, killing 9 people and injuring 42 others. On Tuesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky ruled out any ceasefire deal that recognizes Russia's annexation of Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula Russia invaded in 2014.
Ukraine does not legally recognize the occupation of Crimea. There's nothing to talk about. This is beyond our constitution. It's our territory, the territory of the people of Ukraine. As soon as we start talking about Crimea, about our sovereign territories, we enter a format that Russia wants, which is to drag out the war.
Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports the Trump administration's working to eliminate programs aimed at holding Russia and its leaders and allies accountable for alleged war crimes, including intelligence gathering on Russian atrocities committed in Ukraine. India's military says it's searching for the gunmen who attacked tourists in the city of Pahalgam, Indian-administered Kashmir, on Tuesday, killing 26 people and injuring a dozen others. It's among the deadliest attacks in Kashmir in recent years as pro-independence rebels continue to fight against New Delhi's rule. Hunger and malnutrition are on the rise in Ethiopia due to conflicts, severe drought, mass displacement, and regional economic and political turmoil that's left millions of people without access to food. That's according to the World Food Program, which estimates over 10 million people are facing hunger and malnutrition across Ethiopia, many of whom have been forced from their homes due to violence and the devastating impacts of the climate crisis. The agency warns conditions could likely worsen as its life-saving food assistance response in Ethiopia is at imminent risk due to critical funding shortages, including cuts in U.S. foreign assistance.
Now we are at the breaking point. We've been left no choice but suspend completely the treatment for 650,000 malnourished women and children simply because we've run out of commodities and funding. We are now operating with just about 50% of last year's funding. This means that 3.6 million vulnerable people could lose access to WFP assistance in the coming weeks unless funding arrives urgently.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio has announced a sweeping reorganization of the State Department. The changes will include a rollback of programs focused on Africa, the climate crisis, refugees and human rights, plus cuts to U.S. foreign assistance and the elimination of a body that seeks to investigate war crimes. At least 15% of the State Department's U.S.-based staff will be fired. This is State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce.
We must make the State Department great again. In its current form, the department is bloated, bureaucratic, and unable to perform its essential diplomatic mission in this new era of great power competition. The sprawling bureaucracy created a system more beholden to radical political ideology than advancing America's core national interests.
The families of several Venezuelan immigrants are demanding answers about their relatives' whereabouts after they were arrested and expelled from the United States to unknown locations. One of the immigrants has been identified as 32-year-old Ricardo Prada Vasquez, a delivery driver who was apprehended in late January in Michigan after making a wrong turn, then transferred to an ICE jail in Texas. Vasquez believed he'd be repatriated to Venezuela, but his family and friends have not seen or heard from him since mid-March, when the Trump administration flew three planes carrying over 200 Venezuelans from a Texas detention jail where Vasquez was being held to El Salvador. Vasquez is not on the list of the 238 people confirmed to have been sent there to the mega prison, and he does not appear in any images released by Salvadoran authorities. U.S. authorities confirmed he's been removed from the United States, but a friend told the New York Times, quote, he has simply disappeared, unquote. Meanwhile, the family of 27-year-old Nayarvero Adrian Leon Rangel, who is also from Venezuela, says he was similarly disappeared into the U.S. immigration system. He was taken by ICE last month. His family says they haven't heard from him since. Here in New York, a judge has temporarily halted efforts by Mayor Eric Adams to reopen an ICE office inside the Rikers Island jail complex. Adams first signaled the move after he met with Trump's so-called border czar Tom Homan in February. Two advocacy groups working along the U.S.-Mexico border are accusing Customs and Border Protection of human rights abuses and violating international law over the agency's practice of detaining immigrants and asylum seekers in open-air sites where they're exposed to extreme weather and other dangerous conditions. The Southern Border Communities Coalition and Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law have warned the Trump administration may expand its use of open-air detention in New Mexico, Arizona, and California by having the U.S. military seize control of a buffer zone along a sprawling stretch of the southern border. The groups are urging the United Nations Human Rights Council to review the practice. A delegation of Democratic lawmakers traveled to Louisiana Tuesday, where they met with Tufts University PhD student Rumeysa Ozturk and Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil at the ICE detention centers where they've been jailed since March while they face deportation. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey led the delegation, joined by Congress members Jim McGovern, Troy Carter, Benny Thompson, Jim, and Ayanna Pressley, who spoke to reporters after the meeting.
Well, just another day in Donald Trump's America. Donald Trump and his anti-freedom agenda. that means to control our very bodies, that means to control the books we read, that means to control the free press, that means to control free speech.
The Massachusetts legislators said that Ramesa Ozturk has suffered a number of asthmatic attacks. To see our coverage of all of these cases, go to democracynow.org. President Trump said Tuesday he's not planning to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, even as he repeated his call for the central bank to lower interest rates.
Runs away with things. No, I have no intention of firing him. I would like to see him be a little more active in terms of his idea to lower interest rates. This is a perfect time to lower interest rates. If he doesn't, is it the end? No, it's not. But it would be good timing.
Trump's statement came a day after he mocked Jerome Powell on social media, writing, quote, "There can be a slowing of the economy unless Mr. Too Late, a major loser, lowers interest rates now," unquote. That comment panicked investors, causing the U.S. dollar to plummet and prompting a major sell-off on Wall Street. Meanwhile, President Trump said he expects to reach a deal with Beijing to lower U.S. tariffs on Chinese products substantially from the 145% rate he announced earlier this month, though Trump said the rate would not be lowered to zero. Trump's latest U-turn came as Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent called the U.S.-China trade unsustainable. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said Tuesday the U.S. will begin phasing out the use of petroleum-based synthetic food dyes. Kennedy's accused food makers of mass poisoning children with additives frequently found in junk food. This comes as the Trump administration continues to slash public health programs. This week, the Women's Health Initiative said contracts supporting its regional centers are being terminated in September. The landmark research project enrolled tens of thousands of participants in clinical trials of hormones and other medications over three decades. Separately, Politico is reporting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. may pull COVID-19 vaccines from the government's list of recommended immunizations for children. This comes after the Trump administration scrubbed websites of information on how to manage COVID through tests, vaccines, and treatments. The sites now promote the debunked conspiracy theory that COVID-19 emerged from a virology lab in Wuhan, China. Elon Musk said Tuesday he'll scale back his efforts to slash the size of the federal government to a day or two a week beginning next month, saying his work with the so-called Department of Government Efficiency is mostly complete. Musk made the announcement in an earnings call with Tesla investors Tuesday after the electric car company announced its net income plunged by 71% year over year. In the call, Musk acknowledged his work with Doge prompted blowback against Tesla's brand. On Tuesday, Earth Day, police in New York arrested two protesters with the climate action group Extinction Rebellion after they sprayed anti-Musk messages on the windows of a Tesla dealership in Manhattan's Soho neighborhood. The Environmental Protection Agency has informed 450 staffers that they will be fired or reassigned from their roles working on environmental justice and diversity, equity, and inclusion. The EPA announced the cuts late Monday on the eve of Earth Day celebrations. Here in New York, three more federal prosecutors have resigned to protest the Justice Department's decision to drop federal corruption charges against Mayor Eric Adams in exchange for his cooperation with Trump's immigration crackdown. In a joint resignation letter to Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, prosecutors Celia Cohen, Andrew Rohrbach, and Derek Wickstrom write, quote, "The department has decided that obedience supersedes all else, requiring us to abdicate our legal and ethical obligations in favor of directions from Washington. That is wrong," they wrote. And the Supreme Court's conservative majority seemed poised Tuesday to rule in favor of requiring public elementary schools to provide opt-outs for religious parents who want to pull their children out of classes due to objections to books and course materials that discuss LGBTQ plus themes. The high-profile case centers the school system in Montgomery County, Maryland, which a few years ago began implementing a curriculum for elementary school students, such as requiring storybooks with LGBTQ plus characters aimed at promoting respect for LGBTQ plus parents and their children. A group of religious parents then sued the school board. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor pointed to one of the books in question in her exchange with attorney Eric Baxter, who's representing the group of conservative parents. Uncle Bobby's Wedding is about a girl who attends her uncle's same-sex wedding.
Is there any affidavit from any parent that merely looking at people getting married, holding hands, none of them are even kissing in any of these books, the most they're doing is holding hands, that mere exposure to that is coercion?
Our parents would object to that.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and Yale professor Greg Grandin, author of the new book, America, America, A New History of the New World. Back in a minute.
I don't want to feel down, 'cause my name is getting around. I say the whole world is letting me down now, 'cause I don't know where I'm bound. Yes, I guess I'm going down, 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 and I feel I'm gonna drown. Yeah, I guess I'm going down, 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 and I feel I'm gonna drown. Once I used to be high, now all my friends pass me by. I got teardrops in my eyes. Somebody else got all the smile, because I guess I'm going down, down, down. I'm going down, 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 and I feel I'm going to drown.
Getting It Back by Simande. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with Greg Grandin, history professor at Yale University, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose major new book is out this week, America, America, A New History of the New World. He describes this as a, quote, history of the modern world, an inquiry into how centuries of American bloodshed and diplomacy didn't just shape the political identities of the United States and Latin America, but also gave rise to global governance, the liberal international order that today many believe is in terminal crisis, unquote. The book spans five centuries, from the Spanish conquest to the first Latin American pope, Francis, who was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Argentina, and just happened to die at the age of 88 the day before the book was released. The Nation has published an excerpt from America, America, in a piece headlined, Pope Francis Upheld the Spirit of Liberation Theology. Greg Grandin also has a new piece for The Intercept that draws on the book headline, The Long History of Lawlessness in U.S. Policy Toward Latin America. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. Professor Grandin, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the release of your book. I want to begin with that incredible moment in the White House, in the Oval Office. There is President Trump sitting next to the Salvadoran president, who calls himself a dictator, Nayib Bukele. Yeah. And the moment of the United States and El Salvador, what this represented in the culmination of U.S.-Salvadoran relations, even going back, and I'm sure you're going to go back further, to the 80s, when the U.S. supported the paramilitaries and the military in killing so many tens of thousands of Salvadorans. And now the relationship is around this notorious mega prison, where President Trump says he no longer has control over people he sends there.
Yeah. Well, what struck a number of things struck me about that encounter in the White House. One was, you know, as you mentioned, Latin America is famous for the a kind of form of political violence called political disappearance, in which people were literally just kidnapped off the street and disappeared by security forces. And back then, an element of that kind of crime was the government would deny any knowledge of it. And obviously that wasn't true. The government and the security forces were deeply involved in carrying out and executing the disappearances. But that deniability created another element of terror, the uncertainty where their loved ones have gone, whether among the relatives, among the survivors of the people who were taken. You know, government officials, people would waste their time going through labyrinth bureaucracies, asking questions, and the government officials say, who knows, maybe they went to Cuba, we don't know. And what struck me was Bukele is like, there was no deniability this time, right? Trump and Bukele was like, we got him, we know where they are, and we're not going to give him back. That kind of FU impunity is a different kind of terror, a different scale, right? That, you know, if the uncertainty of that first wave of disappearances created a kind of horror and suffering among people, this kind of performance of omnipotence, we have them and you can't do anything about it. I also was struck by the glee in which they talked about it, the joking about it, like as if they were just talking about, you know, not even human beings, the dehumanization. That was another thing. And let me just also say, this is a little bit of a tangent, but Bukele does like to joke around and with a little bit of irony, although it's not ironic at all because it's true that he's a dictator. And, you know, when FDR visited, Franklin Delano Roosevelt visited Vargas, the president in Brazil, who was a dictator, but was also building a kind of social state. He was a backer of social rights and expanding kind of social welfare to the working class. When Vargas and FDR met, there was a little protest against Vargas. Vargas whispers to Roosevelt, they call me a dictator. And Roosevelt whispered back, me too. And so they were joking about being dictators, but in a completely different circumstance, in the sense that they're building social rights, they're building a social state, they're expanding economic, you know, welfare states, the social rights to people. We're here, we have two people who are talking about themselves as dictators and acting as dictators as they dismantle what's left of the New Deal.
And Greg, of course, you're familiar, you've written in the past about this history of lawlessness from the United States with regard to Latin America. And it seems to me that just the same cavalier attitude that was evinced in this discussion in the White House has been pretty much part and parcel of U.S. policy. We're facing now, for instance, Trump talking about taking back Panama. And in fact, there are actually more U.S. troops now in Panama. Quietly, the Panamanian government has allowed some of the old military bases to open up again as a result of the pressure from the Trump administration.
Yeah, and they'll soon be in Ecuador also. Ecuador is, you know, vying to be a second El Salvador in the sense of a kind of security outpost. This is all in the context of, in a way, of losing Colombia. I don't know if they've lost Colombia permanently, but a left-wing Petro Gutierrez Gustavo Petro was elected president, and he was an old insurgent, and Colombia kind of no longer serving as a kind of forecastle of U.S. power in the region, and the United States now constituting El Salvador and Ecuador as these kind of places in which they're projecting military power. I mean, the bigger question here is if the United States really has given up its role as superintending a global liberal order and the world is reverting back to these kind of spheres of power competitions, then Latin America becomes centrally much more important to the United States as a source of resources, as a security perimeter in which being able to use certain countries as military bases, it becomes that much more important as the world kind of fragments into these spheres of influence, Russia and China and whatnot. And so we'll see a lot more of that, I think, in Latin America in the coming years.
Now, I wanted to ask you specifically about the role of Guantanamo, because most Americans don't really grasp the fact that the United States is holding a military base in Cuba, really against the wishes of the Cuban government still after all of these years. What allows this to continue to occur?
Well, what allows it to continue to occur is just absolute raw power, the power of the United States. And the United States, when it took Cuba and it took Puerto Rico and the Philippines and Guam in 1898 in this war against Spain, it carved out Guantanamo as a military base, as a coaling station, and it had an end date. I think that end date passed for the lease. But once the Cuban Revolution happened in 1959, the U.S. ignored it and just kept Guantanamo and as its own kind of enclave within the revolutionary island. And of course, you know, Latin America has long been a place in which the United States, as a growing empire, has used as a receptacle to cast off its unwanted or the people that it considered kind of outside the pale of belonging to the nation. Prior to the Civil War, many people thought that the United States could avert a war over slavery by basically sending all its free people of color to Latin America, to Central America, to Mexico, to Panama, to Haiti, as a way of lessening racial tensions that, of course, didn't happen. In the 1990s, Guantanamo became the place where the U.S. held refugee Haitians following that country's coup against Aristide in inhuman conditions. And then, of course, during the War on Terror, Guantanamo became synonymous with a war that legal categories could no longer kind of organize, right? So there was no term for these prisoners who didn't belong to any, or we weren't fighting their nations, we were fighting them. So it came up with enemy combatants, and Guantanamo became the place in which they were housed. So there's a long history of this, of course. And yes, it's on the island of Cuba, and the irony of that, since Cuba is one of the few countries that have long resisted U.S. militarism.
And I wanted to, first of all, congratulate you on your new book, America, America, and also ask you why you felt that it was necessary to write this new history of the Western Hemisphere, especially at this time.
Well, I thought there's a lot of books that look at the influence of Latin America in the United States and, you know, and El Norte and how the, you know, the Americas are really all one. But what I was really trying to do is go a little bit further and think about how the tension between first the British and Spanish colonial system and then between Spanish Republicans and the United States gives rise to a set of political principles that become the foundation of the global order. You know, when people think of the founding of the United Nations or the founding of the League of Nations or what, you know, what they talk about the rules-based order, they often look to Europe. They look to Europe's, you know, relationship with its former colonies. And that's the histories that get written. But I, you know, in many ways, you know, the ideas that become foundational to the world after the end of World War II were created in Latin America. When you think about it, Juan, the United States becomes a nation, a single nation on what they imagined to be an empty continent. Obviously, it wasn't an empty continent. Obviously, the Spanish Empire was still there. There was indigenous sovereignties across the plains and across the Rockies. And the United States revives the doctrine of conquest in order to justify moving west as fast as it can. Latin America comes into the world, six republics already a League of Nations. They come into the world already a United Nations. They have to learn. There was nothing like that in history. Europe wasn't like that. Europe was a collection of empires and monarchies that were then expanding their colonial reach, sending their gunboats into the Indian Ocean and flitting around China. Latin America was a true assemblage of bounded nations, and they had to learn how to get along. They both threatened each other, and they both legitimated each other. And they legitimated each other because if one republic could throw off Spanish Catholicism and declare itself independent, then another one could. But they threatened each other because under the old rules of law, what was to stop Argentina from doing what the United States was doing and said, we want the Pacific. Let's just send our settlers over across the mountains and start taking land from the Chileans or the Mapuche or whatever. But of course, they weren't going to do that. They had to figure out a new theory of sovereignty, a new way of thinking about how nations live together. And one of the first things they came up with is the premise that nations aren't necessarily inherently competitive. They critiqued both the United States' doctrine of conquest and they critiqued the old world's balance of power, the presumption that the way you achieve stability and stasis is by each nation or empire pressing their interests, and that creates a kind of countervailing force. They thought that was inherently unstable and would always lead to war. What they came up with was a vision of internationalism in which the first principle was that nations share a kind of common purpose, a shared set of interests, and that they could work together cooperatively through diplomacy. They also came up with the idea that the boundaries of the old colonial system were the boundaries that they were going to accept. They may not be perfect, they may have been imposed by the colonial system, but that's what we have. There's no frontiers, we're not going to be pushing. And now, in many ways, this was a kind of an ideal type of vision. There was plenty of wars in Latin America, particularly in the 19th century, and skirmishes. You know, one Brazil wanted rubber, and you know that was in Peru, and there was lots of border skirmishes. But all of those skirmishes were negotiated under the premise that the boundaries were real, that wars of conquest and wars of aggression were illegal. And all of these ideas are what eventually makes it into the United Nations Charter.
Greg Randon, I wanted to ask you, follow up on you mentioning Argentina, and also follow up on the Pope, and it goes to a major theme in your book. Democracy Now! Broadcast from Buenos Aires for several days. We followed the mothers of the disappeared in the Plaza de Mayo, in the women who lost their children and grandchildren, demanding to know where they were. And you follow the position of the Catholic Church throughout Latin America of extreme extremely conservative force, but also the liberation theology that was so important, and they were counter to each other. Whether we're talking about the church allying with the U.S.-backed regimes in Guatemala and El Salvador. In El Salvador, of course, Archbishop Romero was gunned down March 24th, 1980. Argentina, that is where Pope Francis was from, the first Latin American pope. He was there during the Dirty War from 76 to 83. And I know there's controversy around it's quite murky what happened then and what his role was and his relation to liberation theology at the time. Could you go into this?
Well, yeah, I mean, Pope Francis, in many ways, was a quintessential Latin American. He was born during an era in which social movements, labor unions, and peasant leagues were entering the public sphere, demanding social rights. In his case, he grew up under Peronism. I don't know his position on Peron. I don't know whether his family was Peronist. I have no idea. But he certainly was immersed in that kind of, you know, the bursting into the public sphere of the plebeian. And he was a priest through the Dirty War, as you said, and through all of the turmoil of the 1970s, and there is a murky period, and there's accusations and counter accusations, and it seems as if most of the forces of the left have, the question was whether he did enough to protect other Jesuits as the head of the Jesuit order in Argentina against the dictatorship.
Yeah, and particularly the story of two
Jesuit priests. And one, to his dying day, believed that Pope Francis gave him up.
Named for Saint Francis.
And the other priest forgave and said, no, I believe he did all he could to protect us and as much as he could. He wasn't a liberation theologian. In fact, many thought he was conservative, and there was some talk when he was voted pope that he was picked because he would serve as a counterforce to the political left, which at that time, if you remember, was Chavez and Kirchner in Argentina, and you know it was a very strong movement in Latin America in the middle of the 2000s, in the first decade of the 2000s, and but you know history has this way of working, doing the unexpected, and he turned out to be quite a humanist progressive pope, particularly when placed within the larger perspective of the religious schism between conservative Christianity, which is on the rise, in which there's alliances between conservative Catholics and, you know, dominionist evangelicals that, you know, want to basically take over the political sphere and seem to be doing a pretty good job of it in this country and elsewhere, and that wing of the Catholic Church that still imagines itself as emancipationist, as liberationist, as egalitarian, and he obviously sided with that wing, with the liberationist wing in his pronouncements, in his very being. One of his last acts was calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, which the New York Times didn't bother to mention in its obituary, which is interesting.
Sunday on Easter Day.
Yeah, which was amazing. So, you know, I mean, it was the same thing with Oscar Romero. When Oscar Romero was picked to be Bishop of El Salvador, he was picked because they thought he was conservative. They thought he would defend the status quo. The landed class was very happy with Oscar Romero. And the experience of living in history has the tendency to radicalize people sometimes, and sometimes it radicalizes them in the right direction, in the more humanist direction. And that happened with Oscar Romero, and it happened, I think, with Francis.
And he dies right before giving that speech, which is broadcast throughout El Salvador. Archbishop Romero directly addressing the Salvadoran military. Sadly, the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military, saying, I urge you, I beseech you, I demand you put down your arms.
I mean, it's quite a heresy, right, to order your military not to obey their officers.
Greg, I wanted to ask you this debate between the humanists and elitists and conservative wings of the Catholic Church, as you note in your book, has a long history. And you spent quite a bit of time talking about the 16th century debates between two Dominican priests, Bartolomeo de las Casas and Francisco de Vitoria. What was the substance of that debate, and what's its importance historically, especially in terms of the impact that the native presence on America had on European thought?
Yeah, well, the book does start with the conquest, and it starts with the conquest and all of its horror and all of its suffering. I mean, you know, we're talking, some demographers call it the greatest human mortality event in history. They estimate that there were probably about 90 million people living in the Americas, and within a century, 90% of them were gone. And Spanish Catholicism, when the Spanish Empire arrived and claimed dominion, claimed sovereignty, they knew they were presiding over a populated land. And it sparked a debate among the theologians about how to justify dominion. You know, the reconquest of Iberia, the driving Muslims and Islam off of Iberia was justifiable
Spain.
Because, what's that?
Spain.
Yes, Iberia, Spain. was justified because they claimed that Spain was Christian before Muslim Islam arrived, and therefore what they were doing was just taking back land that had been taken from them. But they couldn't make that argument in the conquest, right? Because Native Americans hadn't known Christ, and therefore they couldn't deny Christ. And so they had to come up with a new justification for why Spain had the right to presume sovereignty over the Americas. And there was a small group of critics, including de las Casas, including Francisco Vitoria, most of them were Dominicans, also Franciscans, that began to argue that you couldn't find any basis of legitimacy. You certainly had no legitimacy to enslave them, and there emerged, in the face of the horror of the conquest and all its unimaginable suffering, there emerged a critique, a quite cohesive critique against conquest, against slavery, almost a critique that almost went to the point of pacifism, and a critique that insisted that all humanity was one. Bartolomé de las Casas is famous for a line, all humanity is one. The actual correct English translation was something, or the whole human lineage is one, meaning lineage from Adam and Eve. But he insisted on the equality of people. There was no difference between Native Americans and Europeans in his mind. And this is the foundation, I argue, of modern political thought, and particularly his rejection of the doctrine of conquest. And now, why that's important, and I kind of trace that out through the book, and this by no means does it ameliorate any of the brutality of the conquistadores and what they did, and the enslavement of Native Americans, and that greatest human mortality event in human history that I mentioned earlier. But it did create and consolidate a pole within the Catholic Church that continued, an emancipationist, abolitionist pole that continued. And why it's important for a couple of reasons. One is, it was important for the nature of the Spanish Empire within the Americas, which I can come back to. But later on, when Spanish American Republicans begin to break from Spain and set up their own independent nations, and then have to start contending with the United States, which is reviving the doctrine of conquest to justify its expansion west, these Latin American intellectuals and political leaders had already at their disposal a fairly coherent critique of conquest, a fairly coherent critique of slavery, that they then, that what had been applied to Spain, they then applied to the United States. And it's that tension and it's that kind of persistence of this ethic that, that becomes the foundation of the international order. Now, I'll also say the other thing that's specific about the Spanish Empire is that the Spanish Empire made no the Spanish Empire knew it was an empire over people. Native Americans were the main thing. They were the people who extracted the wealth out of the Americas and created the world's first universal currency. But they were also the center of Spanish moralism. They were, the, you know, what the Native Americans were, as they were defined by theology, is what justified the Spanish Empire. Now, when you get, jump ahead a couple of centuries and you get to British colonialism, there's, you know, there's no discussion about Native Americans. There's no discussion about, you know, the justification of how to justify colonialism. In fact, the London Company in 1607, when they were sitting around, they had a meeting and they said, well, maybe we should issue a document that justifies Jamestown and justifies, you know, what we want to do in New England. And you know, and I have this debate, and that fully aware that for a century the Spanish have been debating this for a year, for a century. And they basically come to the conclusion, you know, the Spanish priests, the Dominicans, and the theologians have been debating this for a century, and they still can't come up with a workable justification for Spanish conquest. So maybe it's better we don't say anything at all. We just keep our mouths quiet and just do it. So that evasion of responsibility is a major strut in the book.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. I want to talk about the role of Latin America in fighting fascism from the 30s until now. And also I want to ask you about the radical journalist Ernest Gruning. Greg Grandin is our guest, history professor at Yale University, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose new book is America, America, A New History of the New World. Stay with us. Las Tumbas, The Tombs, by Puerto Rico's Ismael Rivera. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're spending the hour with history professor from Yale University, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose book is out this week, America, America, A New History of the New World. Professor Greg Grandin is our guest. So let's talk. We talk about Orban and Hungary. We talk about Holocaust. We talk about those who fought fascism. But it isn't as much talked about who those who fought fascism in Latin America and its key role and what the United States and especially those who are fighting the authoritarian tendency can learn from our southern neighbor. Yeah.
Well, Latin America had the good fortune of getting to fight fascism just as the New Deal was consolidating in the United States, and a shift in the way away from intervention, and a shift away from Washington defending U.S. capitalists and U.S. investment at all costs. So FDR had a much more eclectic approach to Latin America, and basically he gave the left room to maneuver in Latin America. I mean, Spain, in many ways, a lot of grand strategists were afraid that the Spanish, the kind of conflict that you saw in Spain between a kind of Franco representing a Spanish nationalism, Catholic nationalism, allied with Mussolini, allied with Hitler, and fighting a kind of the more liberal currents with liberal and radical currents within Spain, was basically just a preview of a conflict that would eventually drift across the Atlantic and take over all of Latin America. Because the sociology was very similar. Servile peasants, large landed landowners, you know, a militarism, a kind of conservative Catholic hierarchy. Many people saw in the Mexican Revolution a kind of mirror of the Spanish Civil War. And many theorists felt Latin America could go either way. And this isn't even talking about the influence of Germany and Japan and Italy within Latin America. So Latin America was really on a knife's edge in the 1930s. And the New Deal, basically, and it's particularly the left-wing members of the New Deal who were very much interested in Latin America, worked very hard to give space to social democrats and create a kind of really bulked liberalism to a robust conception of social rights and material improvement in people's lives as a way of countering fascism. Like, they didn't beat fascists just by calling them fascists. They beat fascism by offering an alternative. And that alternative was some form of socialism or some form of social democracy or some form of social liberalism. And in one country after another, this kind of variations on social democracy come to power or ally with the United States. And by the time the war starts, that Latin America is pretty much, with the kind of exception of Argentina, is pretty much allied with the United States behind Washington. So when FDR went to war in 1941, he rallied not just his nation, he rallied the whole hemisphere. The United States really, and Latin America was indispensable to the United States. The United States didn't have to fight one battle for resources because it had Latin America. And then Brazil, with that bulge that goes into the Atlantic, was a major transport route that Roosevelt called it the Atlantic trampoline, because the planes would land in Natal and then go straight off, then go bounce over to North Africa, and an amazing amount of war material made it to Europe through that route. So Latin America, in many ways, both materially and ideologically, was key to fighting fascism, both as part of the war, but then internally fighting the fascists within their own countries.
But Greg, there were, as you mentioned Argentina, clearly Juan Perón's era was one that was at least sympathetic to the Nazis, and also the Trujillo dictatorship had a lot of sympathies and certainly for Franco and for fascism. Trujillo at one point had the assassination of a Spanish Republican, Galíndez, the infamous Galíndez case. He was assassinated at Trujillo's orders in the United States. So there was a current, a fascist current that eventually led to many Nazis settling in places like Argentina and Brazil after the war.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I mentioned, that in many ways people, the fear was that all of Latin America would become Spain, that would be a Spanish civil civil war without throughout the whole of Latin America between the forces of progress and the forces of fascism. And that didn't happen. And, you know, in many places, it's because Democrats and social Democrats came to power. In other places, like the Dominican Republic with Trujillo, is because they saw which way the winds were blowing and they got on board with the allies. And then after the war, as you said, it does become a kind of, in some ways, a continuation of World War II. Many socialists thought that the fight against fascism didn't end with the dropping of the atomic bomb or European victory over Germany. Now that fascists were defeated in Europe, the fascists at home had to be defeated. The Trujillos, the Somozas, the Batistas. In the Caribbean, they created the Caribbean Legion, which they saw in, you know, they didn't see it as like looking ahead towards the Cold War. They saw it as a continuation of World War II, that we're going to build a Caribbean Legion and we're going to take out Trujillo, we're going to take out Somoza, we're going to take out Batista and all the little Hitlers that are still kind of, you know, populating Latin America. And of course, that didn't happen. What happened was that the Cold War shifted the terms of debate and the United States shifted its support away from social Democrats and the idea that democracy and development went hand in hand towards an idea that order and stability and development went hand in hand and began shifting all of its surveillance activities away from fascists and towards communists and towards the left. And of course, the irony is that during World War II, the United States invested all of these countries with enormous capacity, military capacity. There was a Lend-Lease program in Latin America where Chile got military equipment and Brazil got military equipment. And after the war, those weapons were turned on the left. There's no better example of this than in Chile in 1948. Chile, a Popular Front government was elected in 1947, but then there was a militant strike in 1948, a miners strike in 1948, and the government turned from the kind of ethos of the Popular Front to putting down the miners strike and basically mobilizing it. Airplanes and military warships to destroy and occupy large portions of northern Chile. And involved in that was a young military officer named Augusto Pinochet, who began rounding up strikers and putting them in a prison camp in northern Chile. So you see how all of this military weaponry so the line between fighting and facilitating fascism in Latin America was always very fungible.
And Greg, we have only a minute or two left, but I wanted to ask you about the Latinization of the United States. There's over 62 million people of Latin American descent living in the United States today. How much is this presence a part of the history that you write about?
Well, the book was long enough, so I couldn't go too far into the migration question. But certainly, and they bring with them the same kind of polarization, same kind of conflicts. I mean, you know, they revitalized union movements in Nevada and Los Angeles. You know, and when Latin Americans, you know, they come to the United States, they don't think that democracy means just individual rights. They believe in things like health care. They believe in things like public education. But then on the other hand, there's also a group of immigrants that come fleeing countries that they consider have gone too far to the left, and they've created their headquarters in Florida, right? Like what we thought was the waning influence of older generations of right-wing Cubans has been reinvigorated by waves of Hondurans and Venezuelans that imagine themselves fleeing left-wing tyrants, Nicaraguans, and so it's contributed to the turning of Florida into this laboratory of Trumpism and headquarters of a kind of Mar-a-Lago as a kind of headquarters of a pan-American Trumpism, pan-hemispheric Trumpism.
What shocked you most in researching this 700-page epic work?
Oh, well, I guess what struck me most, what I was so surprised with was how the good neighbor, we know the good neighbor policy as a phrase associated with Franklin Roosevelt as his treatment of Latin America. But it was also the phrase that they used as to get out the vote in his 1936 reelection. And it became a kind, the Good Neighbor Leagues was set up as a counter to the Liberty Leagues, explicitly anti-fascist. They were meant to embody a certain kind of cultural pluralism and acceptance of the diversity of the nation. And they were understood explicitly as an alternative to the white supremacist Liberty Leagues. And they basically delivered the vote to Roosevelt. He won 20 million votes. He won more votes than any other human being in history up until that point. And he did so running on a policy of social democracy.
Greg Grandin, our guest for the hour, history professor at Yale University, Pulitzer Prize winning author. His new book, America, America, A New History of the New World. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!